Serve It Cold, episode 13. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
We only just got in at 10 last night, and already I want to come home. Mom, you have no idea. I thought we'd have this romantic vacation, horse-drawn carriages, moonlight strolls along the riverwalk, wandering in and out of those wonderful French Quarter shops. No! We scarcely settled in at the hotel. We got up this morning and went out to get our bearings, just wandering down Royal Street checking out the shops. I was just in that perfume shop for 5 minutes, and when I came out, he was taking pictures of some floozy showing off what God intended shouldn't be with our camera.
I was standing on the corner of Chupatulas and Poydras when I saw Narlene approaching from the riverwalk. I assumed that the two piles of shopping bags following her were actually the two Tommies in their best disguises yet. So much for eagle-eyed bodyguards. The line at Mother's was winding out the back door as usual. Narlene took one look at it and said,
"Guys, we can go somewhere else if you think this is too crowded."
The rest of us laughed. Tommy, too, said,
"It won't bite. It's just a line wrap. It'll move on. Just give it a chance."
I turned to Tommy and asked, "Wrap?"
"Short for Rapunzel, stupid."
"Oh, of course. Please forgive me."
"Well, we'll think about it, little John. Do you think they'll have some cracklings to snack on?"
"Tommy, you know as well as I do that they ran out of cracklings about 7 o'clock.
"It never hurts to ask. They may have had to cook more hams today."
The line did indeed move, and we were inside before long. Narlene was still intimidated by the crowd.
"Guys, there's no place to sit. Are you sure you want to do this?"
That was our cue to laugh again. This time, Tommy stepped in with words of experience.
"It would seem so, wouldn't it? But the magic of Mother's is that the line moves exactly fast enough to keep all the seats filled. By the time we get our orders in and get our drinks, the table for four will miraculously open up."
Narlene shot a skeptical look my way. I defended, "He's right. It's magic."
"Hot food! Hot food coming through! Got your hot greens coming right here."
I grabbed Narlene and pressed her against the brick wall just as a steaming cauldron was deftly guided along the line toward the serving bar.
"What was that?"
"Cabbage or collards?" "Yes, definitely collards."
"No, I mean, what's all this hot food stuff?"
If you look behind us, you can see that the kitchen is actually on the opposite end of the building and the other side of the line from the bar where they take your order and prepare your food. So everything except the drinks and the bread has to be brought down the same runway here where the customers stand. The drinks have another completely different line that starts near the front door. We came in the back door, of course.
"Of course. What about the bread?"
"It comes from the elevator that Tommy Two is standing in front of." Within a minute, the elevator dinged, and a short man wrestled 3 bags filled with French bread through its doors.
"Bread! Fresh bread! I got your fresh bread. Coming through, please."
He was quickly followed by a conga line from the kitchen.
"Ham! I got your ham right here. Coming through with the best baked ham in this world."
"Jambalaya here! Hot food! Coming through! Jambalaya right here!"
"Crabs! Soft-shelled crabs coming up!"
The plate of large soft shells, destined for a soft shell po' boy, brought oohs and ahs from the crowd and started me second-guessing the perfection of my upcoming order. I pulled away from the wall and turned back to Narlene. "Everything they make is good. The daily specials are on the chalkboard up there. The purists stick with the single meat po' boys. They use cabbage to dress the po' boys instead of lettuce. You like it. Best baked ham in the world. Says so right above the bar. Roast beef with debris, that's all the little bits and pieces scraped up from the roast pan. Turkey roasted fresh right here. Hot sausage. Soft shell crab is great too. A fairdy is a combo po' boy. Just say fairdy and you get roast beef and ham. Say turkey fairdy and they'll ask you to name your second meat." She was reading the walls and listening to my spiel when someone behind the counter reached up and rang the ship's bell on the wall. All of the employees and about half the customers stopped whatever they were doing and paused for just a moment. And then the din rose again.
And what the hell was that?
That's the stop and take a breath bell. Isn't it a great idea?
I've said it before and I'll say it again. You are crazy, your friends are crazy, and you eat at weird restaurants.
We shuffled down the line for a bit.
So, what do you get here, Jonathan?
Me? You mean crazy me? That's easy. A turkey Ralph with ham and debris, dressed with hot Creole mustard and provolone. Turtle soup, don't forget the sherry, and bread pudding for dessert.
A Ralph?
It's just a Faraday with cheese. Do you know what you want?
Yes, I think so.
Can you remember my order? She spit it back at me, word perfect. Impressive. But I was already gaining respect for her powers of memory. I asked her to order for me, took everyone else's drink order, and waded through the crowd to the end of the drink line. I emerged with the drinks just in time to see my turtle soup ladled into a bowl. Narlene's request to the waitress was lost to me in the crowd noise, but when I saw the gallon jug of sherry emerge from under the counter, I knew I was in good hands. The waitress hooked a thumb through the loop handle, rolled the bottle onto her arm, and with an expert push of the elbow, plopped a glug of sherry that filled the bowl to the brim. Narlene turned away from the counter, my soup in hand, just as a foretop emptied near the window. Before we reached the table, a roving waitress had bussed the table and wiped it clean. Soon, I was once again sitting in front of a bowl of turtle soup in Mother's. My Ralph and a steaming slab of bread pudding, complete with fruit cocktail and whiskey sauce, were on their way. All was good in the world. Yeah, sure. 30 minutes later, our table was littered with the evidence of a great feast. Narlene was still gushing about her jambalaya and my turtle soup, while the Bobsy Tommies were fighting over the last of my bread pudding. It was a damn good thing that I was on a diet. Suddenly, Narlene straightened in her seat with a look of alarm on her face. I started to say something when the cell phone in my pocket vibrated. As I dug my cell out, I could see Narlene was already flipping open the spare I'd given her. It was Gojo.
See, we need to talk, now.
I could hear Narlene through the phone, too, saying,
Hello? Hello?
Gojo, did you call both my numbers at the same time? How did you do that?
Easy, see? Two hands, two ears, two phones. You know I'm a multitasking demon. Narlene, I'm gonna hang up on you now. I've got to do some talking to C. Bye.
I swear, when I heard the word bye, it was all I could do not to disconnect. He continued.
See? Sit down.
How do you know I'm standing up?
You're standing up because you answered your phone, which you keep at the bottom of your pants pocket. See, you can't find that phone without standing up. So who's Jessica Fletcher now, big shot?
I sat down. Not bad, Gojo. What's up? Vera okay?
Vera is great and extra fine as usual, but all is not well in the city of the 40. Stop spending money right now, see? Your client is dead. So is your expense account.
I knew right then I'd been set up. I take it you mean Grantham, not Goat? Murdered. Last night, after 10 o'clock, before 3 o'clock, right?
Damn, see? That's a knockdown for sure. My Fletchiness is already in grave peril, and so soon. So soon.
Gojo, let me talk to Vera.
And I'm out. What a punch, ladies and gentlemen. The title is lost. See? Tell me true, big guy. How did you know Vera's sitting right here?
Too easy, Gojo. Number one, you would never tell me to stop spending money on your own. Number two, the great and extra fine Vera. You're too chicken to tell her right off, so you compliment her while talking to me in front of her. How's that? There was silence on the phone until Vera answered. I asked her, Gojo's revved up about as high as I've ever seen him. What's the deal?
He's just punch drunk from all the late hours he spent in chasing down people on the computer with Lurker. How are you doing, Johnny? I'm worried about this.
I'm fine. Listen, babe, we're running up Gigi's phone bill. Hang up and call me back from your cell. And go out into the parking lot. You'll get lots better reception, but watch out for Homer and that damn BB gun. I disconnected and helped the Tommies load up with their packages. I told them to drop the packages off at their apartment, and then meet me at the Napoleon house, where I promised to tell them what was going on. Vera rang back just as I emerged onto the sidewalk.
You think the phone is bugged, Johnny?
I'm just being careful. Vera, Remember, I was warned that there might be a PI following Landis when we started this mess. That may be a don't pay attention to the man behind the curtain ploy, or it may just be misdirection.
Okay, now I'm worried.
Don't be. I figure I'm about as safe as Latimer and Lily can make me, because I am the documenter of their well-staged alibi last night and this morning. Have the police showed up yet?
No. Dr. Grantham's name has not even been made public yet.
Right. Pending notification of his beautiful, cheating, conspiratorial next of kin.
Yes, but the midday news showed the body being removed, and I recognized the house from the pictures you took the other day.
Oh, great. Not only have I been documenting alibis for the real murderers, I have proof that I was stalking the victim. Honey, I want you and Gojo to go get all the files for this case. Put them in the back right floorboard of your car. Drive back to my store, and Gojo will take your car for a ride while you do some of my paperwork. Oh yeah, while you're at home, take all the dogs out and lock them in the kennel. Before this is all over, our house is liable to be broken into, and I don't want the sons of bitches hurting our dogs.
Johnny, you don't expect that to happen right away, do you?
Absolutely not. They'll want me to go running to the cops with all my pictures first. But I don't want to overestimate these guys, and I sure don't want to underestimate them. Don't talk to Gojo about this. Just do it, and talk about anything else when you're together. Just be careful, and don't be alone until I get back in town. I'm about to call Gojo on his cell and tell him what's up. I've got to wrap things up here. I'll see you guys before dark. I called Gojo. You got somebody to cover for you?
Yeah. Sandra's here, working on the daily logs.
Great. You and Vera are going to my house, gathering everything that has anything to do with this case. Everything. Put it all in a file box, and put it on the back passenger side floorboard of Vera's car. Take Vera back to the store, and leave her with Sandra. You take the car, drive to the Sunflower, leave the car unlocked, and go in and buy something. If the box is still there, go in and buy something else. Got it?
Got it.
Gojo, don't talk to Vera about this. Got it?
Got it.
Go to it. Later. I called Goat and made plans for Sunny picking up the file box and getting it back to the Cradle's vault. I called Lurker and asked him to go to my house, both stores, and Vera's car and sweep them for bugs. He whined a bit, but agreed to do the job. I'd found Lurker through a skip tracer that Big John introduced me to. Even after we had successfully worked together for 6 months, Lurker would not let me know where he lived, nor even which state he lived in. But I realized that he had a good working knowledge of South Mississippi. I did a little trace work on my own and showed up on his doorstep one day. Lurker 76 lived in rural Socher, Mississippi, in a high-tech shack out behind the barn on his grandfather's farm. Of course, he was pissed off and wouldn't answer my emails for a month, but he was impressed that I found him. And when he decided that he really had to have that next hard drive, he caved and came over to the light. Finally, I called Sam and asked if he could meet us at the Napoleon House. I got to the Napoleon House first and asked Larry the waiter for a large table in the courtyard. He graciously showed me to a corner table without any questioning or slander, which had me concerned. I was seated and he was dealing out the 5 menus when he suddenly stiffened. He drew back and shot a piercing look down his aquiline beak.
Oh, it's you.
Larry. And here I thought you'd forgotten me.
Actually, I thought you had died. I lit a candle.
In memory or in thanks?
What do you think?
He stalked away across the courtyard, leaving me to relax and listen to the classical music that is so much a part of the Napoleon House scene. Larry and I have hated each other for almost 20 years. The French Quarter is known for its haughty waiters, and Larry is the haughtiest of them all. I don't remember how I managed to piss him off to start with, but I'm sure Larry does. Our mutual enmity has evolved into an entertaining little game over the years. At least I think of it as a game. Larry revels in his disdain for me, but always gives me impeccable service. I try to be demanding when possible, but I always tip Larry very well. I must admit that a trip to the Napoleon House when Larry is not working is always a letdown. Larry returned with Narlene and the Tommies in tow. I asked Larry if they had anything by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. He pantomimed surprise at my knowledge of anything musical before Gorecki, and asked,
"Chamber music? Opus 30 or perhaps 39?
"Not on your life," I thought to myself. "Larry, I'll leave that choice in your capable hands. Why don't you bring us all a round of ice water and a glass of rainwater Madeira? And the same for our guest, who'll be arriving at any minute. And let us have an assorted dozen of Angelo Brocato's cannolis." Soon, the New World Symphony stopped abruptly, and a totally unfamiliar tune lilted across the courtyard's palms. I could hear a full orchestra, so I guessed we were dealing with an opus. Larry soon returned, weaving his loaded tray expertly around the tables and through holes in the foliage. Sam Taylor was following close behind. As he sat down, Sam said,
"What a coincidence. The music they are playing is my favorite Samuel Coleridge Taylor piece, Romance of the Prairie Lilies.
Is that Opus 39? Larry was somehow managing to place full glasses of liquid on the table successfully in spite of his constant glowering at me.
"That's right, Johnny. That's very good. I didn't know you were a music history expert, too."
"Oh, I'm not. Larry here picked the music for me." There is absolutely nothing that makes Larry more angry than my being kind or complimenting him. I continued, "I'm afraid my music history expertise begins and ends with Cooney Vaughan and the Graves Brothers."
"Ah, yes. The Mississippi Juke Band. Big John used to try to convince me that rock and roll was born across the tracks in Catherine."
"You'd better believe if you sit at this table, Sam. Arlene's brother owns the actual bar where the juke band first played. It's called Rockin' the Cradle." Sam turned to Narlene, who spoke up.
"That's right. He's fixing it up right now. I'm going to work there when it opens."
"Well then, that settles it. I can see that I'll have to make a pilgrimage to Catherine."
"All of you will be invited to the grand opening in about a month. I can guarantee that."
Larry appeared again, with dessert plates and a platter of sugar-dusted cannolis. Sam, who had given his glass of Madeira a sniff and a puzzled look when he sat down, suddenly brightened.
"Johnny, you've outdone yourself here. A perfect sequel to our little Herb Saint feasts last night."
And indeed it was. What in this world is better than sitting in good company over an incredible pairing of food and drink while reminiscing about other feasts? Sam and I took turns describing the incredible food that Chef Ken had created.
"But Jonathan, didn't you have dinner with us last night?"
"That is exactly right. I had dinner with you. I had late supper with Sam and Ken."
"And don't get me wrong. These little things, these cannoli things, are great, but didn't we eat lunch an hour ago?"
"True, but this is late lunch, or perhaps an afternoon snack. Arlene, how do you think I'm able to maintain my figure?" That led to Narlene talking about all the great food she had eaten in New Orleans, and we all had to talk about our favorite mother's meals and the great sandwiches served right there at the Napoleon House. About that time, an aromatic muffuletta cruised by on a waiter's tray and brought me back to the task at hand. "Tommy's, we have another whole muff upstairs in Mick and Patty's fridge. Will you take care of that and restock the pantry for me? Narlene and I are going to have to head for the hills of Mississippi soon."
"Sure, we can take care of another muff. It should be just about cured to perfection by now. I tell you, little John, if you keep coming to town and we end up eating like this, I'm going to be maintaining a figure just like yours."
"Thank you. That brings me to the reason I wanted to get us together this afternoon. Well, the case that brought me down here is over in some ways, and just beginning in others. But I no longer have to keep the trust of my employer. I need to tell all of you what's happened, because I may have unwittingly involved all of you in one royal mess. You see, while I was tracking my targets, they were tracking me. And I think they may have had some very good help doing this. Someone I never saw, but that's the only way any of this makes sense." So I told the story of Trio Grantham, leaving out the most searing details of the continuous floor show that was Lily Banks. I used the telling to inform my audience and to help clarify a working model of reality in my own mind. It's what the neurolinguistic programming crowd likes to call a meta-model. As I talked, this meta-model became more and more solid, and I became more and more worried. It was time to saddle up and get out of town. We'll be right back.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at patiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at dancingcatstudios.com.